By the way, I walked up here and gave some opening remarks. I don't think I told anybody who I am. My name is Doug Johnson. I'm the editor of Touchstone Magazine, followed after our founder, Jim Kushner. So now you know. Our next speaker, I wanted to invite Michael Hamby to this conference ever since two things drew me, put the hooks in me. One was, if any of you aren't already subscribing to Ken Myers' program, Mars Hill Audio, I highly recommend it. And there's some wonderful interviews between Ken and Michael Hamby on that program that first drew me to, brought Michael Hamby to my attention. I also, take out your pens, I want you to write this down. An article by the name of A More Perfect Absolutism. It was in the October 2016 issue of First Things. And I think I was just rereading it last night, and there's one little passage I thought kind of speaks to the theme of our conference here, and I wanted to read it very quickly. Michael writes, concerning the autonomous nature of freedom in the United States and our trajectory of individuality, he says, a life of freedom thus eventually becomes a kind of rearguard action against all those claims that threaten to define me prior to my choosing. To be free, I must perpetually show, even if I have to carve it in my own flesh, that I am the owner of my own body, and that I, not God or tradition or any other human being, or even my given nature, determine its meaning. We see this protest everywhere today, in the proliferation of tattoos and piercing, in gender reassignment surgery, in the euthanasia movement, self-mutilation, in which I alone determine what my body says, becomes freedom's highest creative act. Michael Hamby is an associate professor of religion and philosophy of science at the John Paul II Institute at the Catholic University of America. He's also taught at Baylor University and Villanova. He's the author of two books, most recently, No God, No Science, Theology, Cosmology, and Biology, and a collection of essays provisionally titled On Being, Human Catholic American. And that should appear sometime in 2023. Dr. Hamby's work has appeared in the Wall Street Journal, First Things, The Federalist, as well as other magazines and numerous academic journals. He's also been deeply involved in the movement to renew Catholic education and co-authored the curricula for two schools. Dr. Michael Hamby.
Thank you, Doug, and to everyone at Touchstone. Not only is it a great honor, but it's really a great pleasure to be here. I'm very excited about this weekend and the opportunity to spend so much time with not only with people whose work I respect, but whose company I enjoy. So I'm really happy about this. The theme of the conference is right up my alley. I'm not sure what the organizers had in mind by making me the last speaker of the first day, but I took it as my assignment to set the bar for how bad things really are. In the process of writing this talk, I discovered that though I hope to answer the question given in my title, it doesn't really express all that I want to say, so it's become something of a placeholder. You might be tempted to think in the course of reading it, the new title is Abandon All Hope, Ye Who Enter Here. But in the end, it's just the opposite. And the title as it stands right now is The Politics of Nothingness. Close enough. Hegel once said that philosophy is the comprehension of one's own time in thought. Yet it is debatable whether our time, which is unphilosophical by any measure, can really supply the categories of thought adequate to our historical moment, when momentous, even world epochal changes to every facet of life and every level of human society have become too obvious to deny or ignore. Politics in America today, regardless of political persuasion, seems to be characterized above all by a sense of dread, as if some dark fate dimly glimpsed, delayed by our light-minded optimism and the sheer inertial thrust of our technopolis, has finally dawned. That there is no agreement about the meaning of this fate, though one can now find people on both ends of the political spectrum who speak openly of civil war. That each party to our divide gives diametrically opposed accounts of it and regards the other as the repository of their darkest fears may turn out to be one of its deepest symptoms. But since there is no longer any aspect of American life outside the political spectrum, this sense of dread hangs over just about everything. How are we to understand this? It has been astonishing in recent years to discover just how fragile is the unspoken consensus underlying civil society. None of us could have predicted how fully our electoral politics could descend into farce, or have anticipated just how quickly the fragile bonds of our liberal order could go up in flames. Both the riots of 2020 and the recent aftermath of the Dobbs decision call into question whether even the basic efficacy of the law can outlast the wholesale loss of faith in its foundations, in the foundations of its authority, or the discrediting of authority as such. Phenomena seemingly as widespread among those responsible for administering the law as among those who feel themselves chafing under it. None of us anticipated the breadth, much less the success, of the cultural iconoclasm aimed at destroying the entirety of our civilizational memory. Nor, I dare say, how quickly and thoroughly human nature, already effectively demolished by a reductive and functionalist science, would be abolished in culture, language, and law. None of us foresaw with what scope and power the mutual surveillance of all against all would intrude on our daily lives. But then again, none of us likely envisioned a day when we would each wear our own personal Palantir as a prosthetic attachment. No one really knows what to do about the opioid crisis and other social pathologies devouring working-class Americans of all races. And frankly, much of the ruling class does not seem to care. And none of us can fathom the senseless acts of mass violence, which have now become a routine occurrence that seem to be able to happen anywhere at any time. This pervasive violence, despair, and disintegration raises fundamental questions about the ultimate success of the American experiment. What is left to a people who have believed only in politics when their faith fails them? When they simply cease to believe in the foundations and principles of their own civilization and the myths that make them a nation? Are bureaucratic entanglements and a common antipathy toward reality enough to sustain their unity as a people? I realize that I've left the premise of this question undefended. I've spilled a great deal of ink in other places trying to show how the persistence and even the relative vitality of Christianity in America in comparison to Europe, at least as measured by superficial criteria of sociology, is consistent with the death of God and the absolutization of politics, which is less a question of motive or sincerity than a system requirement of the order in which we live. Here, I can say only enough to try to demonstrate my thesis, which is my answer to these questions and the basis of the analysis to follow. What is left to a people who have believed only in politics when they lose their faith is nothing, or perhaps rather, the nothing. And what follows the failure of politics is not another form of political order, but most likely the end of political community, and therefore of properly human self-government. We seem to be on the cusp of a new age that is at once post-political and post-human, and both for the same reason. In the 12th chapter of his Screwtape letters, C.S. Lewis's senior demon quotes a characteristically beautiful collect from the Book of Common Prayer, which addresses God as the one whom without nothing is strong. Screwtape adds, insightfully and ironically, that nothing is very strong. Strong enough to steal away a man's best years, not in sweet sins, but in a dreary flickering of the mind over it knows not what and knows not why. In the gratification of curiosities so feeble that the man is only half aware of them, in drumming of fingers and kicking of heels, in whistling tunes that he does not like, or in the long, dim labyrinth of reveries that have not even lust or ambition to give them relish, but which, once chance association has started them, the creature is too weak and fuddled to shake off. Weak and fuddled is a pretty good description of our nature of last men. Addled by every pharmacological and digital anesthetic, and by a system of public instruction that has long since confused education and ignorance. Still, I want to suggest that our time is showing that nothing is even stronger than Lewis imagined. There seems to be a powerful nihilism hanging or haunting our social order, a spirit of negation, if you'll pardon the anachronism. That 21st century America has thus far been spared the full weight of this nihilism, that it has produced neither the existential agony nor the orgy of self-destruction that engulfed 20th century Europe, may reflect, as George Grant once suggested, the difference between Catholic and Protestant atheisms and the absence of a living tradition of contemplation in pragmatic America. Where reality has no depths, the abyss seems rather shallow. Which is why, for example, we can seize hold of and redefine the basic constituents of human nature: man, woman, mother, father, child, with hardly a serious thought about what we are doing. We are incapable, it seems, of apprehending the gravity, much less the ramifications of our deeds. And yet it turns out that this very shallowness, the absence of real thought and the incapacity to see and be moved by the truth, may well be a measure of nihilism's triumph. I plan to spend a good deal of time analyzing the social and political manifestations of this spirit and anticipating where it is likely to lead us. But my point in employing these anachronistic terms now is to say that we cannot adequately understand it, cannot comprehend our own time in thought through the standard categories of American political discourse. Categories such as liberal and conservative and basic concepts like rights and liberty do not reach to the root of our nihilism so much as presuppose and therefore inadvertently perpetuate it. To begin to see what we're really up against, we must interrogate our historical moment philosophically and theologically and determine its metaphysical, theological, and religious meaning. If my reading of things is even remotely correct, it will mean that the real drama of our time is the practical and political outworking of the death of God in the institutions and intellectual structures of our society. What John Paul II and Benedict XVI called the eclipse of the sense of God and man. A darkness, we must confess, from which Christianity and the church are not exempt. Indeed, arguably, the greatest crisis internal to Christianity is the pervasiveness of a pious atheism that does not know itself. A form of apostasy perfectly compatible with every kind of religious enthusiasm, in which fideism, moralism, and even doctrinal orthodoxy are superadded from without to forms of apprehending and thinking about the world that are functionally atheistic. But if this is so, then rediscovering, much less living in the light of the sun, preserving a memory of the human and living humanely as a people, will require much more than modern Christianity in either its Catholic or Protestant form, and especially American Christianity, has thus far shown itself capable of. For this is not a darkness that can be overcome merely by a revival of piety or morality. It will require nothing less than a renewal of the Christian mind, such that it is capable of contending at every level, philosophical, scientific, technological, aesthetic, political, with the spirit of negation haunting our world. An entryway into the political dimensions of our nihilism is provided by the late Italian philosopher Augusto Del Noce, who was virtually unknown in the United States during his lifetime, but has recently become something of a phenomenon among American intellectuals, thanks to the translation of his works into English and the vindication of his philosophy by events. 21st century America has made Del Noce something of a prophet. His cultural diagnosis is now truer than he himself could have imagined. But already in the 1980s, Del Noce was warning against a new totalitarianism, more total, if less obviously violent, than the old. The novelty of the new totalitarianism is its scope and its essentially revolutionary character, indeed, its character as total revolution. Total revolution becomes total by bringing the whole of reality, including human nature, within its purview. That is, in sexual revolution, which it does with the help of a reductive science that simultaneously claims to represent the whole of reason and that reduces human nature to an aggregation of biological functions. Fusing eroticism and scientism, Del Noce's terms for the sexual and technological revolutions, the new totalitarianism aims not at dominating the world with a positive ideological content, but is instead a negative totalitarianism of disintegration, he says, aimed at the annihilation of every given order, but especially the metaphysical, religious, and social vision given in the Christian synthesis of Rome, Athens, and Jerusalem. For Del Noce, the decisive event of the 20th century is the triumph of a new kind of atheism, inadequately understood in most cases by its Christian opponents, from which the new totalitarianism springs. This, in turn, is a function of the triumph of Marxism, or rather, its simultaneous triumph and defeat in what he calls the suicide of the revolution. Just as the internal logic of a liberal order that sought to defend liberty above all else seems to be realizing itself in its totalitarian opposite, so Marxism finally comes to fruition in the bourgeois society of well-being in the contemporary West. At the heart of Marxism, on Del Noce's understanding, is an atheism different in kind from the apologetic or scientific atheisms of the earlier 18th and 19th centuries. Marx's atheism was a function of his overthrow of Hegel, the apex of the philosophy of comprehension that began with Plato. Marx rejects the philosophy of comprehension, and therefore understanding, as the goal of thought, in favor of a philosophy of praxis, summed up in one of his most famous sayings, quote, "The philosophers have only interpreted the world in various ways. The point is to change it." But this means that God, being, nature, truth, every form of transcendence, simply ceases to matter. It is not that their non-existence has been demonstrated by argument, as earlier forms of atheism had attempted to do. It is rather that within the new conception of reason, with its conflation of thought and praxis, these have become, strictly speaking, unthinkable. Neither God, nor nature, nor truth are questions that can even be seriously posed from within this paradigm of thought. What matters now is history. The past historical, social, political, and economic conditions that make all truth claims into expressions of ideology, and the future historical conditions that will be changed by human praxis, that is, by science and political action whose truth will now be verified by its effectiveness. Marxist atheism, therefore, surpasses all previous forms by passing into irreligion, which simply erases God and the religious dimension from thought and life. A decisive reason why post-Marxist man was destined to become fully bourgeois, which Delnoce defines as a man whose thought is so thoroughly determined by the category of usefulness that he desecrates everything he thinks about. Delnoce's anticipation of our present is prophetic, profound, and illuminating. Nevertheless, in my view, his understanding of the nihilistic essence of the new totalitarianism is better than his analysis of its causes, which is not so much wrong as incomplete. I have no wish, therefore, to deny the power of Marxism as a cultural force or its role in helping bring about the American present. And rather, I wish to supplement that. But I think it's necessary to supplement that. Taken by itself, there is something reassuring about Del Noce's argument to a certain kind of American conservative, long accustomed to blaming Marxism or other foreign influences for the corruption of American founding principles. It absolves us of a serious philosophical self-examination, a result he would no doubt lament. Yet it is difficult to imagine that Marxism, which never succeeded in establishing the sort of political foothold in the U.S. that it achieved in Europe, could have had such a corrosive influence if our own native soil were not already prepared for it by something internal to the American experiment. And when we dig into that soil a little more deeply, we see that the American Revolution already contains the seeds of total revolution within itself, and perhaps, in fact, achieves total revolution more perfectly than Marxism ever could. In that event, Marxism becomes but one powerful manifestation of a deeper metaphysical revolution already underway, a revolution which reaches its apex in the United States as the quintessentially modern nation. The meaning of America thus becomes a philosophical problem unto itself. Now, this is not as abstract as it may sound. Every political order unfolds within a horizon of meaning, some basic shared conception of what and how things are that gives our actions and their deliberations their intelligibility, gives them sense. Ours is no exception. It is no accident that the architects of modern political order, from Thomas Hobbes to Thomas Jefferson, were also natural philosophers. Those we seem to have forgotten the fact. Nor is it an accident that the pursuit of scientific and technological progress has been, above everything else, our collective raison d'etre. America, the quintessentially modern nation, has always resembled the New Atlantis as much as the Second Treatise or the Federalist Papers. Jefferson believed that his 18-year presidency of the American Philosophical Society, founded by Benjamin Franklin to promote useful knowledge and the intellectual backbone of the young republic prior to the growth of universities on these shores, was more consequential than his two terms as President of the United States. Article 1, Section 8 of the U.S. Constitution grants power to Congress to, quote, grants Congress the power to, quote, promote the progress of science and the useful arts, prompting Leon Cass to comment that the American Republic is, to my knowledge, the first regime explicitly to embrace scientific and technical progress and officially to proclaim its importance for the public good. Modern politics unfolds within the same new vision of nature that gave birth to modern science. A world composed not of intelligible forms, but of quantifiable forces. And this shared metaphysical foundation ensures that the pursuit of scientific and technological progress is not simply one of the many activities undertaken within modern democratic society, but its defining activity, its very lifeblood, and therefore a regime of necessity, as it has become for us. At the core of this metaphysical vision is the elevation of possibility or power over the givenness of the actual world, an inversion of the ancient priority of act over potency. The liberal concept of rights elevates possibility over actually in the political sphere by creating what my friend D.C. Schindler calls an enclosure of a field of power around each citizen, transforming every given reality that would define me prior to my choosing, God, the moral order, and now we discover my own nature, into a possible object of choice. Undertaken from the same Archimedean point outside nature, occupied by every experimenter before a field of technological possibilities. Liberal order thereby undermines these basic realities while appearing to uphold them. Though this was often concealed in the earlier stages of liberalism by the inertial force of a historically Christian culture and by a theological positivism that imputed design to nature, which is the modern meaning of teleology, and made moral choices obligatory on pain of eternal punishment. But the hollowing out of these realities by the absolutization of possibility would make their collapse inevitable and swift, like a dead tree blown over by a windstorm. And when the mighty wind of historicism did finally sweep across the American plain, setting mechanism in motion and reducing the last anachronistic remnants of human nature to time and dust, it would bear the name not of Marx, but of Darwin. As Marx stands to Hegel, so Darwin stands to William Paley and the mechanistic tradition of natural theology that dominated the Anglosphere in the 18th and early 19th centuries. Darwin, as Stephen Jay Gould once said, simply inverts that tradition, substituting natural selection for God as the creative agent of evolutionary change. To just that extent, Darwinism extends in negative form the vision of nature underlying the American experiment. It represents what one might call, following Del Noce, the suicide of mechanical theology. As such, Darwinism represents not only the ultimate failure of that tradition, but also its success. And the fact that this success brings human nature fully within the purview of the empiricist and experimentalist vision is one reason, we might suggest, that its triumph exceeds that of Marxism. Marx may have understood himself to be founding a science of society, but Marxism never fully ceased to be philosophy or succeeded in becoming an empirical and experimental science in the Baconian sense. It is in America where biology becomes philosophy that philosophy becomes world. The impact of the Darwinian Revolution upon the world of American Protestantism and thus American culture cannot be overstated. Emancipated from the long tradition of Christian Platonism and having abandoned nature to the mechanistic philosophy and Baconian science from which Darwin himself emerged, American Protestantism at the end of the 19th century had no choice but to assimilate to the progressive vision of nature or try to stand athwart history on the fideistic grounds of biblical literalism, a resistance that was doomed to fail. The story of American Protestantism in the first decades of the 20th century is, to a significant degree, the story of its practical assimilation to the Darwinian vision. and its acceptance of the progressive and eugenical assumptions that were establishing themselves as cultural axioms, even for those who opposed Darwin's theory on doctrinal or moral grounds. That's another story, part of which I've tried to tell elsewhere, and I don't have time to repeat it here. To those interested, I would recommend the work of Amy Laurel Hall, her great book, Conceiving Parenthood, and Christine Rosen's Preaching Eugenics. But to invoke the names of Bacon and Darwin is to point to the scientific and technological dimension of liberal order that flows inevitably from its metaphysical essence. As liberalism in its political aspect elevates possibility over actuality in its concepts of freedom and rights, liberal order in its scientific and technical aspect valorizes power through the pragmatic or functional conception of truth inherent in scientific rationality. The real meaning of Francis Bacon's conflation of knowledge and power, truth and utility, is not that we understand nature for the sake of controlling it, which is true. It is rather that we understand nature by means of controlling it, that the truth of our knowledge is identical to our power, identical to the various kinds of control we are able to exercise over natural phenomena. Nothing succeeds like success. We know our experiments are true when they work. In this way, reality is measured by what is technically possible, what is by what we can do. Or as John Dewey would later say, things are what they can do and what can be done with them. This transformation of the meaning of both reason and things is a fundamental source of the pervasive thoughtlessness that I referred to earlier in my remarks, and why there is no such thing as a profound question in American public life. Astonishing, but true, and obvious once one sees it. St. Thomas Aquinas once said that, quote, the name intellect arises from the intellect's ability to know the most profound elements of a thing. For to understand, intelligere, means to read what is inside a thing, intus legere. Sense and imagination know only external accidents, but the intellect alone penetrates to the interior and to the essence of a thing. But where there is no longer an interior, where there is no longer an essence, and therefore nothing to penetrate or read, intellect, in the traditional sense, is no longer intelligible or necessary. If by manipulating variable X in an experiment, I can produce result Y, and this in turn allows me to move on to the next experiment, Z, it's superfluous to ask what truth or cause or an entity is, or even what X and Y are. And in fact, there is no meaningful way to think from within this form of reason about what anything is, or to pose questions in the what is form. All meaningful questions are now functional questions. How many? How far? How fast? Where from? Where to? Under what influence? To what effect? There is thus a disincentive to understanding, an inducement to thoughtlessness, built into the heart of our most authoritative form of reason, the one that now determines what it means for us to think. It is important to see that the seeds of total revolution are already contained within this vision of things, and that revolution becomes all the more total the more its political, scientific, and technological aspects converge. into one, what I call, biotechnocratic order. We saw an anticipation of this in the eugenics programs of the 1920s and 30s. We are seeing this order emerge more fully now in the new eugenics that attends the sexual revolution, in the merging of politics, medicine, and information technology, especially with the advent of biometric technology, and in the vast science experiment being performed on the nation's children, necessitated by the elevation of transgenderism to a social and ontological archetype. I'll have more to say about that in a moment. Suffice it for now to see that the actual world, the world that precedes me and defines me prior to my choosing, is a threat to freedom thus conceived, just as the givenness of the natural order is a threat to the advance of scientific and technical progress. Indeed, freedom only becomes real, only moves from potency to act, as it were, by negating and overcoming everything that threatens to define me prior to choosing. Just as science discovers the present limits of possibility, discovers the ultimate limits of possibility by perpetually transgressing the present limits of possibility. The absolutization of possibility, therefore, in the liberal conception of freedom and truth, necessitates a war against every form of antecedent order. Because possibility is infinite, and the infinite cannot be traversed, the war must be interminable on every front. Once launched, there can be no end to the process of negation in whatever form it takes. Anti-fascism, for example, notice the priority of the negative, needs fascists hiding behind every bush. Just as fire needs oxygen, there can be no end to them. If racism did not exist, we would have to invent it. Joshua Mitchell has offered a profound analysis of wokeness as a despairing religion parasitic upon Christianity, and he's right. There can be no atonement, save for total annihilation, for the sin of being and having been. We can hope that the supernatural humanity of the black church in America, or what is left of basic American decency, or even the sedation and stupefaction of the masses may stave off that consequence. Thankfully, history does not obey logic with mechanical necessity. But make no mistake, annihilation is where the logic of wokeness leads. Finally, there can be no rest for science, no end to its progress, save perhaps for the limit of a habitable biosphere. To renounce the technological imperative that what can be done must and will be done is, on this understanding, to abandon reason itself. The logic of liberal order is thus the logic of perpetual revolution with an institutional form, a utopianism without a utopia, promising the interminable pursuit of happiness and forbidding its arrival. This is the soil in which something like Del Noce's decomposed Marxism could take root. The negation of the transcendent reality of God, being, nature, and truth leaves a void in which technical and political power become absolute. The essence of totalitarianism, then, consists not in the abolition of rights, but in the abolition of truth, which leaves power as the fundamental reality and establishes politics as the total horizon of meaning. This is a built-in tendency of modern politics as such, whether it's in its Marxist, technocratic, or liberal form, which appeals to the laws of nature and nature's God notwithstanding, is limited by no transcendent or external principle such as the church, and acknowledges no horizon beyond the political over which it is not the final arbiter and judge. The recent codification of a radical new philosophy of human nature by the U.S. Supreme Court illustrates the point. There is no totalitarianism so total as that which claims authority over the meaning of nature. And cases like Obergefell and Bostock show that the power of the American judiciary to define what is real is effectively absolute. Yet it was one of Del Noce's great insights to see that the absolutization of politics ultimately destroys the very conditions of possibility for political community. Namely, the universal reason, common nature, and shared order of reality on which rests the distinction between authority and power and the efficacy of law. In contrast to the modern sense of power, which we can liken to a kind of force, authority is essentially symbolic. It represents an order beyond itself that is true and real. But this means that the efficacy of authority, in contrast to the power that acts principally from without, consists in its capacity to elicit recognition and consent from within. This is what we mean when we say that the law or the truth obliges, that it compels by virtue of its own self-evidence. Or as Dignitatis Humanae put it, quote, the truth cannot impose itself except by virtue of its own truth, as it makes its entrance into the mind at once quietly and with power, end quote. It is authority and not power, the willing acknowledgement of truth and goodness and not the Hobbesian fear of punishment, that is the true source of law's efficaciousness. In a Hobbesian world, the law can compel obedience only as far as the state's power of coercion extends. Whereas in reality, we obey law most of the time out of the tacit assumption that the law represents what is really true, good, and just. Absent the authority of truth, adherence to law and the semblance of basic social cohesion have to be extrinsically and forcibly compelled by legal and extra-legal means. While those responsible for administering the law cease to be any longer obliged by it, except insofar as it is a useful instrument in the achievement of ideological ends, in which case the law has power but not authority, which is to say that it is no longer really law. Authority, the acknowledgement of a binding order of reality to which we all belong and in which we all participate, is thus the foundation of every political community. It is a precondition for a politics that is anything other than civil war conducted by other means. Where there is no authority, no acknowledgement of a binding order of reality beyond politics, there is no longer political society. Politics then becomes what our politics have in fact become, not the shared deliberation about means to given ends, but the attempt to conquer, subordinate, and increasingly even erase the memory of one's enemies. Seen in this light, one can hardly imagine a clearer declaration of the end of political society than the assertion by Justice Kennedy in Casey versus Planned Parenthood that the right to liberty contains the right to define one's own concept of existence, of meaning, of the universe, of the mystery of human life. Nor a greater measure of how this absurdity has taken root than the role that identity has come to occupy in American political discourse. Whether expressing an unbridled freedom of self-determination or the absolute determinism of a mechanistic order of nature, and it is often invoked both ways as needed, often by the same people, identity marks the point beyond which any further analysis or criticism or even speech becomes impossible, illegitimate, and violent. Hence the feedback loop of ideological muzak automatically triggered by sins against identity, as if one's mind and soul had been replaced by a recorded message. Think of Berkeley Law Professor Kiara Bridges' response to Senator Josh Hawley's question about whether people with a capacity for pregnancy are women. I am a woman because I identify as a woman, And I identify as a woman because I feel like a woman, or rather, because I feel like what I feel a woman must feel like. It's turtles all the way down. Anything but a total capitulation to this unreality is bigotry. There is no possibility, there is no possible argument against such assertions, no rational resolutions, because the very assertion is a renunciation of both reason and the common reality that grounds the possibility of argument in the first place. Assertions of identity, therefore, act as a principle of annihilation that negates reason, obliterates our common nature and a common order of reality in which we all participate and to which we all belong. And even the very language by which in our pre-ideological experience, mama, dada, we recognize a world in common. Nothing we see is very strong indeed. The sexual revolution is thus not only nihilistic, it is the zenith of nihilism thus far, destroying both what is most common and most intimate to us, not only in our self-understanding, but in material fact. Its complete triumph would mark the end of political society and make the new totalitarianism, which may thus far seem theoretical and abstract, painfully concrete. Day by day, we are already seeing that the annihilation of human nature, the abolition of the basic human realities of man, woman, mother, and father, is going to require a great deal of us. It will require new laws, a new morality, a new history, a new kind of education, a new conception of the family, and a new language. It will require a new fusion of medicine, biotechnology, corporate power, and politics. For there can be no marriage equality without reproductive technologies and commercial surrogacy as an archetypal form of procreation, and without a public program to make them available to any combination of persons who wants them. Just as there can be no transgenderism without the vast, unaccountable science experiment being performed on a generation of the nation's children and a publicly supported regime of puberty-blocking hormones and surgical genital mutilation. These and other biotechnical interventions yet unimagined are integral to both the conceivability and the practicability of this new regime. They are presupposed by Shulamith Firestone, Judith Butler, and every adherent of this ideology. This is why I say that the sexual revolution is really the human or post-human face of the technological revolution. Best understood not according to our civil rights mythology as a moment in the ever-forward march of freedom, but as a moment in the ever-forward technological conquest of human nature. A moment ago, I suggested that where there is no acknowledgement of transcendent truth, there is no authority, and that where there is no authority, there is no political community. Where there is no political community, the obligation to obey the law extends only as far as the power of coercion extends, which necessitates extension of that power to everything. In other words, it necessitates the invention of that great Leviathan that Thomas Hobbes called a mortal God. Thus, we see that totalitarianism is not another form of politics, but the end of politics. That is, the end of properly human and humane self-government. And disturbing trends already well underway throughout our society begin to show us what our post-human, post-political regime will probably look like. It appears, for one thing, that the Hobbesian ambition to submit ourselves to a mortal god of our own making is more perfectly realized on a technological than on a political plane. Almighty Google, unto whom all hearts are open, all desires known, and from whom no secrets are hid, more interior to me than I am to myself, more closely approximates the divine attributes of omniscience and omnipresence than any political institution bound by the human limits of time and space. As Shoshana Zuboff puts it, there is no place where big other is not. And as a common power to keep us in awe, political rule pales in comparison to rule by internet, where the mere possibility that the Furies could descend upon anyone, any place, any time for the most trivial indiscretion is awesome enough to induce what Zuboff calls anticipatory conformity and the blankness of perpetual compliance. And this is but one of the new Leviathan's almighty powers, as the summer of 2020 showed. New technologies have catalyzed unprecedented new powers and new forms of political agency without political responsibility, exercised completely outside the traditional channels of political deliberation and decision, and attributable to no particular agency whatsoever. A police shooting in Minnesota can spontaneously provoke riots around the country and indeed the world before our politicians can brush their teeth in the morning. Compared to powers of such scope and immediacy, a few hundred people gathering under a dome for part of the year to deliberate policy and pass laws seems positively antiquated. Why Congress really doesn't have anything to do anymore besides raise money and conduct show trials. I read once where Ted Cruz called Google the public relations arm of the Democratic Party. We would be closer to the truth if we began to think of the Democratic Party as the political arm of Google. It is questionable, and to my mind doubtful, whether such power, once unleashed, can be brought under political control and governed by political means. It seems that revolutions tend by nature to take on a life of their own beyond the intent or the control of the revolutionaries. And once launched, they cannot be easily recalled. Certainly, there are certain nodal points where we can identify the inputs of particular agencies that are refracted through the various systems comprising our new Atlantis. This social media platform turning off the spigot of information favorable to an out-group. That bank denying its canceled patrons access to their own money. And if we had a political society and a functioning system of law, we might be able to do something about that. But this very fact reveals the nature of technocracy as a system in which agency is diffused throughout. A system whose ensemble behavior is irreducible to the actions of its individual component parts, however important these parts may be. This is why I say that technocracy is not the rule of technocrats, but the rule of nobody, which is not at all the same thing as the absence of rule. Who, after all, is responsible for the sudden explosion of riots in the summer of 2020? Who is the responsible agent when someone gets canceled? Who bears the responsibility for that vast science experiment performed on the nation's children? Who is responsible for the epidemic of rapid onset gender dysphoria? Judith Butler? Big Pharma? The internet? A corrupt education system, Hollywood, fashion, Joe Biden, parents, the devil? Yes. We can identify particular agents whose input into the system catalyzes downstream consequences, but none sufficient to account fully for the ensemble effect of the system as a whole. The answer with all such deeds seems to be that they are the work of everyone in general and no one in particular. Moreover, technology does not wait on politics, but comprehends, exceeds, and engulfs it. making political action almost wholly reactive to technological possibilities that exceed the political imagination and defy political control. We already know how to do things to ourselves and to our posterity that we do not know how to think about. Already, it is possible for us to manufacture children, for whom the once natural question, "Who is my mother?" has no natural, obvious answer. We are now on the cusp of doing things that most of us, including many who are presently contributing to their eventuality, will scarcely be able to imagine until they are an accomplished fact. It is impossible to legislate in advance against such eventualities, which set in motion cause and effect trains that are not linear but viral, extending in every direction at once like an organism growing its bulk in three dimensions. By the time we begin to understand the meaning of an unanticipated and undesired technological intervention launched into the stream of history, whether it's the computer, the smartphone, a social media platform, the contraceptive pill, IVF, a puberty-blocking hormone, a gene-splicing technique, synthetic gametes, EZPGD, or any of a thousand other examples of science fiction turned into real-world research projects, the decisive deed will have already been done, and its place will have been established within our overarching regime of technological necessity. It is little wonder, then, that a sense of dread hangs over the land. For a post-political, even post-human future seems like an unavoidable fate, or at least like a fate that we cannot avert by political means. As important as it is to use those means to delay it or soften the blow of its arrival. However, if totalitarianism consists not in the abolition of rights, but the abolition of truth, then overcoming this fate, or at least enduring it in faith and freedom, is not, in the first and fundamental instance, a political matter. It may be helpful in this regard to remember that for the ancient world, the first enemy of freedom was not tyranny, but necessity. And overcoming it was the work of philosophy, which allowed man to transcend it. Likewise, deliverance from a fate that we seem otherwise powerless to avoid does not depend upon the success of the American experiment or the restoration of the nation. Rather, it depends upon the rediscovery of the truth about God, about creation, about nature, and about ourselves, a truth obscured by centuries of perpetual revolution and by the diminishment of Christianity, a truth that allows us to transcend fate, not least by suffering in hopeful witness to it. The dream, the great modern and liberal dream of a Christianity without suffering, it seems to me, is over. Discovering this truth is not simply a matter of doctrine or of morals or of biblical interpretation, though it is, of course, all of these. It is not simply a matter of moral courage, though this will be required. It is also an enormous labor of thought, a philosophical labor, to take every thought captive to Christ and to bring the truth of God and creation rigorously to bear on every aspect of life. We will have to think and look very hard to rediscover this truth in its fullness, but we do not have to look far. It is an ancient and fundamental Christian principle, and it also happens to be true, that evil and falsehood are privative, parasitic upon the goodness and the truth that are the fundamental reality, the really real. This fundamental truth, this reality, is always already present and at work, in our apprehension of everything whatsoever, and even in our very attempts to deny them. The omnipresence of the truth is why St. Augustine thought he could discover it by looking within himself. It was within, he was outside. Abolish the good, wrote Dionysius the Areopagite, and you will abolish being, movement, life, desire, everything. Thankfully, the abolition of the good is, in reality, beyond our power. And rediscovering that in every sense, in all of its ramifications, rediscovering the good in reality is the key to rediscovering the fullness of the Christianity given to us by God as our one chance at deliverance from a hell of our own making. Thank you.
Boy, if you don't have a subscription to Touchstone, I'll tell you that will appear in our pages soon, and you're going to want to read that. Again, I don't know if anybody has any questions. Actually, I have one, and it's a simple one, but I want to ask you, what is Marxism? And the reason I ask that is because I think there's two ways of thinking about it. We think of it as a bunch of failed economic policies that we're never going to put in place. Or if you're listening to talk radio, people, you know, you hear Marxism, that's Marxist, and it's usually referring to some government affront against the libertarian paradise or something.
Right.
So give me a definition of Marxism that I can carry with us.
Well, let me give you the one that, first of all, it's actually a great and difficult question, and there are about 10 different senses in which one could interpret the question itself, right? I mean, it's as a historical question, as a philosophical question, et cetera. Let me give you what I think is Del Noce's answer to the question, and it will, I think, be relevant to the thing you're concerned about. That also concerns me. I mean, it's very easy, and particularly, I think, and I mentioned this in the talk, right, for Americans, especially conservatives, to lay the blame on a Marxism which we don't understand or that is something of a cartoon. Yeah. And it allows us, as I said, you know, not to look within. On Del Noce's understanding, the very core of Marxism, the very heart of Marxism, and there's a tension within Marxism. It's the tension that produces what he calls the suicide of the revolution. I mean, on the one hand, you do have this economic dimension, right? And you do have not only this economic dimension, but the economic dimension in the service of a kind of eschatological vision, right? The flowing of human freedom in a kind of as the culmination of the proletarian revolution in which there are stages and so on and so forth. And some of that, some of that actually has underlay the attempt of certain well-meaning Christians to try and appropriate Marxist thought, right? Because what Marxism really is, this would be, you know, a Maritanian interpretation, for example. What Marxism really is a moral protest against decadent Christianity. Yeah, exactly. And you know that we can preserve the moral impulse and purify the metaphysical side. Del Noce says no. Del Noce says, actually, the problem is that does an injustice to Marxism understood as a philosophy, that it is fundamentally philosophical. And at the very heart of of Marxism as a philosophy is the rejection of the philosophy of comprehension in favor of philosophy of praxis, right? Which transforms, which is not only just that we should go out and do good deeds, right? It's like the pragmatists on the American side, that this is, in fact, what reason is. Reason really is measured by practical effectiveness. And once you absolutize that, it actually undermines the other side of Marxism, all you're left with is praxis without a moral or eschatological or real economic vision. This is why Del Noce says is that the triumph of Marxism is its defeat. Right? Its defeat as an economic and political program is the result of the logical outworking of its triumph as a philosophy. And at the core of the philosophy is this rejection of the intelligibility of being and reason as comprehending or understanding in favor of a praxis changing the world. And it's that that then, the real fruit of that, on Del Noce's terms, is not a kind of atheism rooted in argument, right? To show that atheism is the rational superior is rationally superior to its theistic counterpart. It is a conception of quote unquote reason in which the very question of God, and for that matter, the question of truth, is no longer even meaningful. And so that horizon just disappears from human life. And therefore, we become fully bourgeois, right? Determined by the category of usefulness. So, I mean, there is a profound, I think, insight into that. I don't think, as I tried to say in the talk, I think there are sources for the same development and perhaps even a more perfect realization of that development outside of Marxism in the American tradition. But as far as the essence of our conundrum, I think Del Noce nails it. So I don't know if that treats the question.
Yeah, a lot to think about there.
my wife always says, you ask me you ask me what time it is, and I'll tell you how to make a watch. I have to watch. I have to be very careful about that. So I apologize.
Maybe Marxism is the absolute rejection of reason. To some extent, or truth. Do we have any other questions?
You said that Darwinism in the late 1800s left American Christians with basically the option between assimilation to Darwinism and its kind of eugenic implications. Or a kind of fideism. 130 years later now, what do you think Christians have the choice between?
I think Christians are actually the only people left on earth to defend. The Christian task now is to defend reality and the reality of nature, the reality of the human being. In order to do that, I mean, it's an enormously complicated endeavor, right? Because in a context such as the one that I described, arguments don't avail for much. But I think we have to make them. And I think we have to make them not necessarily even because we expect to win. In a certain sense, that would be subordinating the task of understanding to practice again. We have to make them because they're true. And we have to make them because unless we ourselves remember and see and understand what the human being is, unless we can make intelligible sense of the world as creation in a way that doesn't require us to simply reject science, but that allows us to actually really critically engage it. You know, unless we can undertake that kind of irrational endeavor, I don't think we can fulfill our mission, which is to stand for the truth. So that's what's left to us. And I do think, you know, there are intimations here and there of a kind of recovery of Aristotelianism in the natural sciences, imperfect though it is, that's a place to start. I mean, phenomenology, though I do not think phenomenology adequate as a kind of first philosophy, at least brings to the fore ineliminable dimensions of human experience that cannot be accounted for in reductionist terms and must be if we're to be true to reality. So I don't know if I've answered your question. Again, I can tell you how to make a watch. What is left to us now, I think, is this enormous task of reappropriating our intellectual tradition anew and rigorously, rebuilding the education of our children from the ground up. To go back to graduate school and begin studying philosophy and theology after you've spent 24 years being trained as a pragmatist, I see it every day, and I myself, in a way, had to overcome it. It's an enormous task. We need to do a better job forming young Christian minds and souls. This is why I got interested in Catholic education, right? From the very beginning, it's an enormous cultural and civilizational task. Handing on the tradition in a way that's not fideistic, that allows us to think. But that's the job.
I think we have time for another question.
You basically answered what I wanted to ask, but it's going to take time for what you just said. This is like, I have a 16-year-old, and...
So do I.
And, I mean, as much as we raise her in the Christian world as much as possible, I see around her, the kids around her are lost. I don't know if that, what do we do about the kids now, I guess?
The best we can. The best we can. I certainly don't. I mean, I think my kids are turning out okay so far. I'm relatively pleased. But I have no formula. We have tried very hard to give them the best, and have been very involved in trying to give them the best education that we can. We've tried to make them thoughtful people. We've asked, sometimes I think one of the schools that I'm working with now, we've started speaking this way. I mean, I'm very ambivalent about catechesis in a certain sense, because catechesis tends to mean giving children the answers to questions they are not asking. And it's hard for those to be very gripping. We need to give them the questions. I mean, one of the ways to put what I just tried to say about our thoughtlessness is that inherent in our pervasive conception of quote-unquote reason is the forbidding of certain fundamental questions, certain natural human questions about what life means, who I am, what the good is, what justice is. We live in a society that's premised on the idea that those questions cannot be answered. And education, for the most part, therefore, consists in not asking them. It's nice if you can have, if you have a community that raises those questions, or if you can put your children in front of things like literature and art in which that provoke the question for them. But it's also important to ask those questions around the dinner table. And it's, I think, also important to ask those questions in the world that they're in. I don't think cloistering them works. I tend to think there is an innocent of as doves stage of parenting and a wise as serpent stage. And at some point, they've got to begin to ask hard and critical questions about the things they see going on all around them. I hope that helps. Good luck. We can pray for each other. I'm sure we both need it.
Okay. One last question.
Not a question, just a follow-up statement and maybe an answer. I think the next generation might also need to see some martyrs.
Well, they probably will. Yeah. It's funny because I wrote about this one time. I wish I could think about the terms that I used, but there's something about the kinds of persecution that this order inflicts, right? Invisible. Cancellation, death by 1,000 paper cuts, that deprives us even of martyrdom in a way, at least for now. I mean, that may not be coming, but there are all kinds of ways to inflict suffering systematically and invisibly that we're likely to undergo first. But you may very well be right. I hope if that day comes, and if it were to come for any of us, that, you know, we have the faith and the courage to embrace, to do it. I certainly don't embrace or long for it. I don't think we're supposed to do that.
All right, Dr. Michael Hamby, thank you very much.